Hello, it's Wednesday, June 16, 2021, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the studio in the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kylie and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, celebrating the year's best journalism, reporting about racial justice and the global pandemic have dominated this year's Pulitzer Prizes. After nearly 60 years, American Airlines is joining the likes of Delta and Southwest in putting an end to the American Way. Magazine, that is. And
my big fear is that the aliens already landed, but they landed during Comic-Con, and then no one noticed them.
It's hard not to laugh, but maybe we shouldn't be. Global sightings of UFOs are taking off again, and now the Pentagon is taking them seriously. There's a lot more that hopefully we will get to before our half hour is up today, but first we're going to talk about something else. At one point, it too was considered a conspiracy theory, one too out there to be true, that COVID-19 started in a Wuhan laboratory and an accident and leak from that lab was blamed for the pandemic, not the random naturally occurring pathogen that had been believed to be the start. Well, the past few weeks, the reporting has gone deeper, prompted in part by President Biden's order that intelligence agencies give that lab leak theory a second look. And what's come of it? Well, the Washington Post published half a dozen stories about that lab leak theory on the front page since late May, and several other publications are going back and posting editor's notes to stories that are in their archives. And even comedian Jon Stewart is going all in on the lab leak theory now. This is from Monday night's Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
What do you mean by that? Do you mean like there's a chance that this was created in a lab, there's an investigation?
A chance?
Well, if there's evidence, I'd love to hear it.
There's a novel respiratory coronavirus overtaking Wuhan, China. What do we do? Oh, you know who we could ask? The Wuhan novel respiratory coronavirus lab. The disease is the same name as the lab. That's just a little too weird, don't you think? And then they ask those scientists, they're like, how did this... So wait a minute, you work at the Wuhan respiratory coronavirus lab. How did this happen? And they're like, a pangolin kissed a turtle.
That conversation went for another 5 or 6 minutes. You can watch the whole segment on our links blog. Ernest, let's put a historical lens on this, though, as we look at how the reporting has evolved and has changed over the course of the past year. It's started out diminishing and discounting the lab leak theory. Is it that the reporting was wrong, or is it that this is a novel coronavirus and situations and information has just naturally changed?
Well, I think when you're dealing with science, things are going to change based on what is the current information that we have. And throughout this pandemic, you've had certain things change over and over again. I mean, think about it. A year ago, it was all about sanitizing. It was all about social distancing, masks, that sort of thing. And then as we moved on, the social distancing became less. When you should wear your mask and when you shouldn't wear it, those rules changed. Everything changed. Well, the investigation of it has also changed. I mean, that theory was one of the theories that was out there from the beginning, along with, well, possibly there were bats, which are well known in Wuhan, which is why the lab is there. And the bat could contaminate an animal, which does contaminate a human. That's another theory, which is still under investigation. So as you move forward, things begin to change. The problem with this particular situation is that everything was seen in a political lens. Every time science changed, every time a new theory came up, every time there was an investigation, it all got thrown into the political partisan bubble. And then all of a sudden you start talking about, well, this is a conspiracy theory. This needs to be investigated and it's not because of political reasons. And if you're China, do you want to be branded as the country whose research spawned a global pandemic? That's also a part of the entire process.
Well, and obviously, the Chinese did not want that theory to be one that took off. And you're right, it was seen as purely political at that time that Donald Trump and the Trump administration was putting more pressure on this lab leak theory being where it was. One of our colleagues here at the Journalism School who has a very long, rich tradition in science and health reporting, Allison Young, wrote an op-ed for the USA Today back in March suggesting that this theory is not one that should be dismissed and that these lab leaks happen much more often than we might think, and that in some ways it was almost a matter of time until a leak like this could cause a pandemic of this size.
Yeah, well, Allison's piece, what makes it really good, it's an op-ed, but it is a heavily reported
piece that
really relies on her own experience and her own sources as, as you said, a longtime investigative health reporter. And I think to pick up on something that Ernest was saying, I think the reason this story was dismissed a year ago was that it was being pushed as part of a partisan agenda. And if you recall the context in which the lab leak theory was, and it, by the way, it really wasn't a lab leak theory at that time. The theory that was being propounded, at least between the lines, but sometimes explicitly, was that the Chinese deliberately planted this virus. And that's kind of crazy. So I think, the fact that it was being really introduced as a way of scapegoating the Chinese and making political points for an administration that was struggling to get control of the situation here, and it obviously flubbed it, so was looking for somebody else to blame, that was the context in which it was being viewed a year ago. A year later, as Ernest said, science moves on. There's a lot of questions about how much access the World Health Organization really had to the Wuhan lab. And I think the fact is, Allison's theory is much more plausible, that this was not deliberate, but it could have happened accidentally. As she points out, it has happened accidentally before, including in labs in the United States. So it's a different context, a different time. And I think news organizations are taking a second look at it and being open about it, as they should be.
And as they should. I mean, you're right. The news organizations should take a second look at this. I mean, even the Biden administration, as you pointed out, they want to investigate it. I mean, really what this boils down to is it is very important to find out how this started so that there can be some sort of not just historical, but also thinking about the preventive measures in dealing with this going in the future. I mean, one of the things we keep talking about is that in 1918, we had a pandemic, and many of the things that we're doing today came out of that. But there are other things that could have come out of that had there been more investigation. Same situation here. The problem we have now is that it has become so politicized. There's this fear that we won't get to the bottom of it and be able to learn from it because it is so, it has become so politicized.
Okay, so speaking of coverage of COVID-19, Columbia University awarded the 2020 Pulitzer Prizes for the year's best journalism, books, drama, and music. The New York Times took home the award for public service journalism for its coverage of COVID-19, described by the awards committee as prescient and sweeping. And Ed Yong picked up an award for The Atlantic in one of the two explanatory reporting awards. But it was the coverage of this country's racial reckoning over this past year that captured the jury's attention. One of the things that stood out to me was just how many of the local newsrooms picked up awards. That this wasn't, you know, the Washington Post didn't win one this year. The New York Times won just the one, which is almost unheard of in that combination. But 14 local newsrooms, 2 freelancers. This was an opportunity for local impact to really be recognized.
And I think the reason is because the local newspapers were able to capture what this movement meant to their communities and in their communities, and then be able to nationalize it to what was happening in the rest of the country. And people could see that it wasn't just something that was happening in Minneapolis. It was happening all over the country and, in fact, all over the world. And these were individual stories that really in many ways encapsulated and created a narrative that would then move from place to place.
I think the Pulitzer judges also, the Pulitzers know they make a statement with their awards. And we've talked here about how imperiled local journalism is. I am sure that was a calculation, wanting to highlight and make a big deal of journalism that was done locally. And also, let us not forget, I think the point you made, Amy, about the freelancers' involvement is really key. There were a lot of freelancers who were badly injured covering this, and some of them don't have health insurance because they are freelancers. So I think the Pulitzer Awards, when they do things like this, it's great because they really recognize and help the public recognize the contributions that are being made by some of the unsung heroes of our profession.
You know, I think the other thing that this year's Pulitzers did, when you look at it in its totality of all the categories, is that it really, there are a lot of young journalists, a lot of young creative artists, a lot of young authors who are doing this work, and they gave them credit for that. So it's sort of it was the up and coming Pulitzers, because these are the people who are going to be in the running for these types of stories moving forward. And the other thing I think is very important is that they're doing a different kind of journalism. And what I mean by that is it is much more in the trenches, almost going back to where we were doing, say, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the LGBT movement, and other areas where it's the journalists on the ground who are actually in there. Granted, the Washington Post and the New York Times, they will continue to win for the policy and the big picture, but here it's that on the ground.
Those publications have the resources to be able to fund that on the ground reporting. One of the stories that keeps coming up for me as I think about the Pulitzers was from the Indianapolis Star and the reporting that they had done on the weaponization of police dogs. And one of the reporters on that team is one of our alumnus, Ryan Martin, who graduated from the journalism school in 2010. And that's and mind you, that is a paper that has a rich tradition of investigative reporting, especially in the last 5 to 10 years, having broken the Larry Nassar story as well. But that's the type of story that also requires relationships with sources, really getting in there and doing that on the ground reporting in a way that took what was happening in the relationships with police and really localized it to that market, to that city, to that community.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Another one of our Missouri School of Journalism graduates, a classmate of mine, Ernest, we were talking a little bit earlier, one of the book prizes. Tell us about that one.
I thought that was fascinating.
was fascinating.
Great book.
So Marcia,
have you read it?
I've read about it,
okay.
But I intend to read it.
So Marcia, and I never pronounced her name right. Is it Chatelain? I think
that's
it is.
Why I was asking.
Well, I mean,
Years. Sorry, Dr. Marcia, if you're hearing us.
Sorry, Dr. Marcia, but and I'm a fan of hers because I've read her work a lot. This book is about the relationship between McDonald's and the African-American community, both the good and the bad. I'm in the process of reading it right now, so I haven't read the entire thing. But it really delves into what kind of an impact a franchise like McDonald's has in the economic as well as the cultural meaning of these communities, and how it helps and in some ways has some negative impacts on what's going on, and it sort of tracks that trajectory. But she's done a very good job of at least from what I've read so far, of really delving into that, about how franchisees, how these major corporations can have an impact on communities.
I've heard her interviewed on the book about the book, and I thought it was just such a great topic, and I was not the least bit surprised to hear she was a journalism school grad, because you can see those are news instincts that are built into that work.
Yep. A lot of real deep reporting that was in there. There was another honorary citation offered as well. The Pulitzer Committee also noting, giving an honorary citation to Darnella Frazier for her filming of the death of George Floyd and the impact that that piece of video had. In the moment, it was really kind of an exciting thing to have happen, although upon deeper reflection, and there are some other opinion pieces that are on our links blog, there are people who are of the opinion that this didn't really go far enough, that perhaps instead of an honorary citation, the Pulitzer Committee could have really looked at its relationship in some of these areas and created a new category, perhaps in citizen journalism, and given her an actual Pulitzer Prize, that the citation didn't mention trauma, didn't mention racism, didn't get to the heart of what her, I don't want to use the word work, but what her fast thinking and her decision to keep that video and then sharing it truly represented.
I agree with a lot of that.
Yeah.
But I think journalism itself is having a reckoning right now. We within journalism have an existential crisis about how are we covering these communities? How have we covered them? How do we plan to cover them in the future? And we're trying to figure it out. There's this argument between what is objectivity and are we really capturing the authentic narrative of these underserved communities that for most of, at least most of my time in the profession, has a lot of it has not been done effectively or at all, to be honest with you. And so we're trying to figure it out. And I think that's where Pulitzers are. They're trying to figure it out. And this is a step in that direction. Who's to say that that won't happen in the future? I mean, you know, it happens with the Grammys, it happens with the Oscars. They're all trying to figure out how they're going to do this. And there's going to be some movement forward and then maybe some pushward back, and they'll figure it out as they go. Yeah, but this is a part of that conversation.
You can see that they're adding. I mean, they've now got an award for audio reporting, which, you know, this was strictly a print organization. So I think this is an evolution, as Ernest said, and certainly I think it's set off an interesting conversation. That's a good conversation to have. But kudos for the Pulitzers for recognizing the contribution that this young woman made.
Because I would say that that story, not just George Floyd, but what happened in its aftermath, would not have happened
absolutely
without
not
that
her.
Video.
Absolutely not.
Without her. And this acknowledges that.
Right.
So moving on, Jeffrey Toobin's 8-month suspension has come to an end. He returned to the airwaves on CNN last week. You might remember he was benched after being caught exposing himself on a Zoom call with former colleagues from The New Yorker. He tried to explain himself to Allison Camerota.
One of the ironies of this whole incident is that for decades you have covered the bad judgment and sexual proclivities of public figures and politicians like Bill Clinton and Anthony Weiner and Elliot Spitzer and Donald Trump, and I could go on. And so, you know, of course it begs the question, why didn't you have better judgment?
Because I didn't have better judgment, because I'm a flawed human being who makes mistakes. And there is no defense for my conduct. The only issue is what should be the consequences. And The New Yorker made one decision about the consequences. CNN made a different decision, fortunately, for which I'm very grateful. But I am not going to come up here and like split hairs and try to come up with justifications or explanations. It was wrong. It was stupid. And I'm trying to be a better person.
So he describes it as moronic and indefensible. The New Yorker clearly agreed, firing him based on what he says even deeper into that segment, that they fired him solely based on that incident. There was nothing else in his history there. Like, they told him that flat out. Yet CNN seems to be okay with it, gave him a timeout, and then invited him back on. If that isn't a fireable offense, Kathy, what is?
Yeah, what's indefensible about this is CNN's decision. I mean, it's insane. And a lot of the conversation around this in the ensuing days has been, entirely appropriately, in my opinion, focused on if he weren't a prominent white guy, would he be invited back? No, If a woman had done something, if there were even a wardrobe malfunction, that
Which has
woman
happened.
Exactly, and that woman would not be invited back. I think this is a classic case of double standard. And I mean, what he did was so egregious. Your description was actually euphemistic.
I was trying to
I know,
be gentle in case people had children
are,
in the car
with dinner,
them.
This is
yes.
a dinner hour
yes.
conversation.
If their children
let's
around.
Just put that out there
yes.
so that I think that I just this is if there ever there were a one and done offense on the media mm-hmm. on I mean with your colleagues I just words fail me.
I have to agree with you. I mean, you know, if
well,
you talk
good.
To
I've here's been, the thing, I, if, I'm here's glad the to thing, hear you agree
if you talk if you talk to an HR person, they're going to go like, what? You know, we're going to give you 8 months and then we're going to bring you back and everything is okay. It's like, no, I don't think
well, and
so.
What's interesting about that is like Matt Lauer isn't coming back. Charlie Rose didn't come back. I'm trying to understand where CNN is kind of the cheese that's standing alone
well,
here
in
providing
would,
this pathway
here's
back.
Here's where they would come back if someone used that argument. They would say, this is a one-time offense, whereas theirs were, you know.
There was a pattern?
There was a pattern there. We don't know if there was a pattern here. Well, you
so,
know, but
so
but
here's
still,
where I'm going to come back on that one, Ernest.
But, okay.
Some things are so egregious.
No,
well,
I'm in agreement with you.
Be
I
one
agree.
And done.
That is,
yeah.
What he did was a one and done.
And we have been in trainings where we even discussed at length during some of our power shift trainings, which mm-hmm. focus specifically on gender-based harassment in the workplace. You said it was a first offense. It was the
first offense
we knew about.
Right. Thank you. I was going to say that.
And he said himself he didn't realize his camera was on, that he had thought the camera was off at the point that it was happening.
But if you were talking to people, how could that be the case?
Well, and the other thing is...
no, he said it was a break. They were in a break during the meeting.
How can this guy ever go on air without people thinking about that?
Well, and if I'm the producer, I don't want to book him.
Right. How does he go on the air and represent, talk about other people?
To me, that's going to be the hard part for CNN is, you know, how do you have him on the air when a high-profile situation comes up, especially as it relates to... something similar to what mm-hmm. he did, and right now almost anything because if you're looking at him and you're listening to him, you're gonna go like, but isn't he the guy that did the, you know?
Exactly.
and by the end of the segment, he's even like making fun of the fact that O.J. Simpson was making fun of him about this. So yeah, okay. So this next topic that I'm gonna bring up, it's almost tongue in cheek because I can't believe we're really talking about this. But maybe that's because I'd like to think I'm a little bit more down to earth. See what I did there? Because we are talking about the increase in UFO sightings. Back in May, 60 Minutes did a special focusing on the footage recorded by Navy pilots and released to the public. In that special, the man who runs the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program said that our government has moved beyond believing in UFOs and is now tracking them. Here's Neil deGrasse Tyson, again, on CNN.
I wish we had better evidence than monochromatic, fuzzy Navy video. You know, if we're being visited by aliens, you know, we upload 6 billion high-resolution color photos and videos to the internet every day. We have unwittingly crowdsourcing the observation of the planet. And I want better evidence than that. And just because you don't know what it is doesn't mean you then know what it is. I'm content to say that's mysterious. I don't know, maybe it's a glitch in the hardware. And if you're gonna say, no, it's not a glitch in the hardware, are you really sure? Are you so sure that you're ready to believe that intelligent aliens are coming to visit us and showing up on F-17 fighter pilot video? Is that more likely to you than maybe you missed something in your hardware?
So, Kathy, I don't know. I can't even wrap my head around this one.
Yeah, it's strange. And what really has given this legs are interviews that have been given by some pretty prominent politicians, one of them a former president of the United States, Barack Obama, who, you know, didn't say he believed it, but he didn't knock it down. And then Harry Reid, the former Senate Majority Leader, I think, actually was involved in getting some funding appropriated for these studies. And he talked at some length about it a week or so ago on NPR. So, I mean, I don't know. I think everybody, there's this, even smart people want to believe that we're not alone. But when you hear one of the country's leading physicists be so commonsensical about it, it's...
He makes a very good point. Yeah. I mean, you know, we...
The Comic-Con point from the beginning of the show.
Okay, that was funny. Okay, that was funny. but I mean, the point that we just aired, I mean, he in many ways, he's right. I mean, we video and take pictures of everything. So, and I mean, he's right, high-resolution pictures. So for us not to have been able to do that in this case... You know, really makes you think, well, you know, if they are there, then if they're here, if they've been here, if they're here now, maybe we should have them on video, in a photograph, something. You know, you got to show me something. However, when you have a former president of the United States start talking about it, you got to think,
What does he know?
It's like he's got some high level clearance there, you know. He may know something that we don't know, but he can't really say because of that non-disclosure thing they have once you leave office, you know. I'm just saying.
Okay, so one more thing before we go today.
I also subscribe to USA Today and American Way magazine. That's the in-flight magazine. Some great articles in that. They did this great profile last month of Doris Roberts and where she likes to eat when she's in Phoenix. Illuminating.
So that, of course, was a clip from The Office, and poor Michael Scott. It's the end of the road, or shall I say, wheels down for the American Way magazine. American is following the path set by Delta and Southwest. After nearly six decades killing off the in-flight magazine, if anything, though, this really speaks to the differences in the availability of in-flight entertainment and how completely out of date these publications have become.
Well, you know, I thought about that because, you know, you send us what we're going to be talking about on the show.
No surprises. We all know ahead of time.
That's right. And so I happened to be on an American Airlines flight. The magazine was there. I opened it up. I flipped through it. Mm-hmm. And the reason I was flipping through it was because all of this wonderful technology you're talking about
didn't work.
Wasn't working. Okay. I had nothing. I couldn't get on Wi-Fi, the whole nine yards, and all you had was a magazine. And the whole time I'm sitting there thinking is that the next time I get on this plane, this magazine's not going to be here. What am I going to do? So, you know, I'll download something, whatever, which a lot of people do, and I do as well. And so for that reason, I think, you know, the magazine moving on is it's time. But I'm, you know, to be honest, I'm going to miss it.
Yeah, we'll be sorry. My late sweetheart used to say, you know, if they invented paper now, people would just think it was an amazing thing. They would say, look, you can fold it. You can stick it in your bag. You don't need a cord. It's just fantastic.
You can make paper airplanes on an airplane and throw it at someone.
And you can put it in the bottom of the birdcage. So there are so many uses for print on paper. But so I do think, and interestingly to me, I think print will eventually make a comeback. When I talk to students now, they prefer long reads in print.
Okay.
So mark my words.
Okay. Well, we are pretty much out of time for this week. Thank you for spending your last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. It's under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments, and see what we'll be talking about on our next program, too. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing the show, Aaron Hay for the audio, and Tim Pilcher for our original theme music.